Welcome to Impossible Podcasts. Hello, and thanks for joining us on another Impossible Podcast, where we've got a double treat for you today. My name's PG Bell, and last weekend I ventured down to Brighton on the south coast of England for FantasyCon 2011, the British Fantasy Society's annual convention, where writers, editors, publishers, and most importantly of all, readers, get together to share their love of fantastic fiction. And there were some big names in attendance this year. John A. Lindquist, author of Let the Right One In, Kim Newman, freelance journalist, horror aficionado, and author of the cult novel Anno Dracula, Rob Shearman of Dalek fame, Paul Cornell, and sci-fi's living legend, Brian Aldiss. More than 500 people sweated it out in record-breaking temperatures to attend the discussion panels, the Q&A sessions, the film screenings, and the book launches. One such launch, by Dark Continents Publishing, was that of Quiet Houses, the portmanteau horror collection from Simon Kurt Unsworth, which you may remember I reviewed in a recent podcast. Simon took some time out to talk to Impossible Podcasts about how Quiet Houses came into being, how he became a writer, and what he thinks the future might just hold for the horror genre and the publishing industry in these tempestuous times. One brief note, we recorded this interview in what started as a quiet corner of the bar, but it steadily filled up with people as we went along, so the sound quality varies a little from place to place. I'll interject here and there with my impressions of the weekend, including the controversy that erupted the moment my back was turned. But for now, over to Simon. Simon, thank you very much for talking to us, first of all. People have probably downloaded the review already, so they might be familiar with the premise. But if not, Quiet Houses, 30-second pitch, what's it about?
Quiet Houses is a collection of base-specific ghost stories, generally, but it's a portmanteau collection, so it's seven stories with a linking story around it that all comes together in the last story. And they are, all of the stories are set in the northwest of England. Four or five of them certainly are set in genuine places. The others are inversions of genuine places that I didn't feel, for reasons of litigation, would allow me to use the real versions. And if I've done it right, it will hopefully creep you out and scare the crap out of you.
Worked with me. Really.
Good, I'm glad.
So how did Quiet Houses come about exactly? What was the process that led you to write it?
It's something that's... My first collection was called Lost Places, and that was 18 stories, and there was no link between the stories other than I had written them, and they were a whole range of different things. And when I came to think about a second collection, I kind of wanted to just do something that wasn't quite a novel and wasn't quite just another collection of randomised short stories. And I, for a very long time, had an idea about someone collecting ghost stories, but I'd never known why. So I was thinking about that, and then I got involved with Dark Continents Publishing, who sort of said to me, have you got anything that you could do? Originally, actually, we were looking at World Horror in March, and so they asked me if I'd got anything I could have done for them then. And like a fool, I went, oh, I have this idea about a collection of linked ghost stories with a linked story at the end, having not really thought it through. And they said, okay, write us that then. So I immediately had to start thinking about what was the link, why was he collecting ghost stories, and it just grew out of that. And the place stuff, the place-specific stuff, is because I have got very into the idea of kind of very specific places that if you ever go to Morecambe, you will recognise the places I've written about. You will see some of the buildings that I talk about. You will see the road names, the Merry House in Scale Hall. The whole geography is perfect, other than I've shifted the borders of the town to make it in Scale Hall rather than Explore Along. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying doing all that stuff around. This is a real place, and I'm now cursing it, and it's great.
So these are places you're quite familiar with. I mean, did you grow up in that area? Or?
No, I'm Mancunian by birth.
Ah, right.
I moved to Lancaster. I lived between Lancaster and Morecambe, and I moved there in the end of 2000 with my wife, and we stay there. We're still there now, and we like it, and I think it'll take a lot to get us to move out, to be honest. So all of the stories are based on places that I know very well. the ones that are not based on real places are based on versions of places that I know well. There's a hotel that I go, well, we used to go to for a drink, that's in there. There's a pub in Manchester that lent itself to the only story that's in Manchester in the collection. So, it's a collection of places. It's almost like a homage to those places, those places that have been important to me and remain important to me, you know, now.
And you've spoken already a little bit about the portmanteau format. Were you a fan of those old Amicus 70s films?
I was. A bigger influence, I have to say, was probably John Probert's collections. He's done two portmanteaus so far, Catacombs of Fear and another one whose name slips my mind at the moment, and he'll kill me for it. And I love both of them. And the Amicus stuff alongside that, although, curiously enough, I've only just started rewatching the Amicus stuff. I almost deliberately didn't rewatch them prior to Client Houses because I didn't want them to be an influence in the types of story. But that kind of idea of almost gathering around in a train station and telling each other stories and then there being a reason for it was kind of the starting point. But John Probert's work is a big influence, certainly Amicus. Dead of Night is another one that with a very strong kind of thread that runs through them. I have no idea if I have done a similar thing or not, but it's been fun trying.
I mentioned in my review that the central thread deals with questions of reason, and specifically scientific reason and the scientific method,
yes,
when it comes into contact with the supernatural. Now, your central character doesn't seem to have a problem reconciling the two, which in this day and age appears to be a fairly rare view. Is that deliberate, or did that just grow naturally out of the story as you went?
No, it wasn't a deliberate thing I set out to do, because it's always felt to me like you can entirely believe in science and entirely believe in the supernatural. The whole point of the supernatural is it's simply things that we have not explained yet. Those things may be, and I'm not particularly a believer or a disbeliever, but I'm a believer in the fact that science hasn't learned, you know, a millionth of the stuff that it will eventually hopefully learn. So it was just a question of Nakata, in some senses, is a reflection of what I would like to be if I was an investigator in those things, in that he has a sense of scientific rhythm, but he has also a sense of the fact that that scientific rhythm doesn't kind of catch everything's beat, and he's looking for some of those other things. And then, ultimately, scientists are human beings, so that they have things that drive them, they have things that are important to them. There's a part of me that thinks it's very amusing that most of the kind of the really rigorous atheists that make it onto the television spout faith. They simply have a faith that there isn't a God and a faith in science. But half of the scientific rules of 100 years ago we now know to be wrong. In 100 years' time, half of the rules that we know now we will know to be wrong, or at least, you know, will need to be elided and built upon. So that's where Nakata came from, was just this sense that actually, and you also, when you have a character that's in lots of different things, you have to have a reason for them being there. It's why policemen are popular, it's why private investigators, because they have a reason to be involved in the stories. So doing that with Nakata gave me a reason for him to be chasing down ghost stories, and then looking at what they meant to him, and trying to build in that kind of emotional content.
It was very entertaining reading Nakata throwing himself into these situations, and he would constantly find himself slightly out of his depth.
But I think that's what good science should be. Mm. Good science, not in the sense of, you know, we've accidentally set the time bomb going, but, you know, good science should be about thinking what would happen, not what would happen if we did X, but what would happen if we thought through the principles behind and ended up in a position, you know, LSD was, you know, paracetamol LSD, they are, or aspirin, sorry, and LSD. You know, Abby Hoffman made a mistake in the lab and created a whole kind of, first of all, a whole counterculture and a massive painkiller. Those things are important, that when you do stuff, there are byproducts, there are accidents, and that's what Nakata is. He's trying to work out what's going on, but he doesn't actually know. He's got a set of theories that he's trying to work out, do they fit? But most of the time they don't. And I do like also, I have to say, I do like heroes that can't quite work out what they're doing. It's just a personal thing, but I kind of like people who are baffled.
Simon will be back to tell us about his experiences as a writer in just a few minutes, but I want to take a moment now to share my experiences at FantasyCon, and hopefully give those of you who couldn't be there some impression of what it was like. As you probably gathered from my introduction, Fantasy Con is a very literary affair that celebrates genre writing in all of its formats. Novels and short stories, of course, but also screenplays, comics, and even poetry. In short, if you're a writer or you love reading, this is the con for you. And this year felt bigger and more ambitious than usual. The move from the dreary streets of Nottingham to Brighton seafront lent the whole affair something of a carnival atmosphere, and the programme of events had been expanded. The film screenings made a welcome return after a couple of years' absence. I attended a midnight screening of The Devil's Rock, a tale of Nazis raising hell, quite literally, on the eve of D-Day, written by Paul Finch, a man with several Doctor Who credits under his belt, who was on hand to answer questions. And John Alvida Lindquist introduced Let Me In, the American remake of his own Let the Right One In, and, if you're interested, he's deeply proud of both versions, but prefers the original. He also used to be a stand-up comedian and a magician, but he politely declined to perform any tricks for us. I saw Kim Newman hold court in a very relaxed Q&A session. He was officially there to promote his new Professor Moriarty novel, The Hound of the D'Urbervilles, but happily chatted to us about everything from his video dungeon column in Empire magazine to Rupert Murdoch and the recent phone hacking scandal. I spent the rest of the weekend propping up the bar, chatting to my fellow conventioneers, and browsing for bargains in the dealer's room. I caught my train home on Sunday morning, so I missed the controversy surrounding the British Fantasy Awards ceremony that afternoon. A controversy so big, it even made the papers this week. But more of that in a few minutes. For now, here's Simon Curtainsworth again.
I think it's fair to say that it's been a good couple of years for you as a writer. Your name has been cropping up with increasing frequency. And of course, yeah, this weekend's launch is just going to be the latest step in that. I mean, what, can you tell us a little bit about your career as a writer? Because is it fair to say you're still a relative newcomer to
the world? Absolutely. I have written on and off for most of my life, to some degree or other. I started seriously writing in 2001 to try and cope with some long commutes on trains that I was doing, actually. And the first thing I did was I wrote a novel that wasn't very good. And I started writing short stories because I went and did some creative writing classes to get me into the rhythm of stuff, and it was, you know, that lent itself to short stories rather than novel chapters, and it was a purely practical thing in that sense, and I found that I enjoyed them. My first published story was in 2007. I sent a whole bunch. A friend sent me, actually, when my son was in hospital when he was born, when he was born very prematurely, and a friend sent me the Ashtray Press's book. I think it was Acquainted with the Night, and I have a very clear memory of reading it with my son asleep on my shoulder, and sending him an email that night to say, thank you very much, I've had a really nice afternoon reading this book. And he said, they're looking for submissions for their next anthology. This is the email address of Barbara Roden. Send her some stuff. So I did. Not having read anything about Ashtray Press, not knowing who they were, other than having read one book. And they liked what I sent them. They published The Church on the Island, which was then taken for, got a World Fantasy Award nomination. It was taken for Steve Jones' Mammoth Book of Best New Horror. So I set the bar very, very high on my very first published short story, which is slightly uncomfortable. Thank God it didn't win, otherwise I'd have had the World Fantasy Award, I'd have had nowhere to go.
start at the top and work your way.
Yes, basically, yeah. So I carried on writing. I had some more stuff with Ashtray for a while. My first collection was supposed to be with a different publisher. That didn't work out. And Ashtray, for a very complicated reason, basically said, well, actually, we've been wondering about doing it. We sorted out 18 stories and they launched at World Horror last year. In the interim, I had some other sort of anthology publications. I've had two more stories in Steve Jones' Mammoth Book of Best New Horrors, of which one launches here again. This is the third one is this weekend. Nice. He also took Church on the Island for his very best of Best New Horror, and I've still not quite worked out why, because I've not quite worked out what he likes so much about it, but he does, and I like the fact he does. I'm not going to complain about it. No. This is my second collection. I have another two collections signed off on, not written. One of them's written, one of them isn't written. So yeah, it's going great guns, but it's all accidental. It's just you write stuff and you see if people like it, and sometimes you get asked to write stuff and sometimes you write it on spec. And I seem to be lucky in that so far people are enjoying it and people are liking it, and I haven't had a backlash yet. Fingers crossed it doesn't happen for a while.
Now, we are, of course, at the British Fantasy Con.
Yes.
And I've been coming for, I think this is my fourth year now. And there seem to be two big debates that continue year on year off, almost without progressing, it seems. And the first is the state of horror as a genre. Where do you stand on the state of horror as a genre? I know it's a very big question.
I think there are two elements to that question. I think you have to differentiate between the state of mainstream horror publishing and the state of the horror genre. The state of mainstream horror publishing is clearly not very well at the moment. There are one or two authors breaking into places like Asta and stuff, but most of the time it's very, very hard to get. If you look into Waterstones, my local Waterstones has three bookshelf sections of dark fantasy and one of horror, and that's a worry. However, if you look at the state of the horror genre, I think it's fantastically healthy. There are some real talents out there producing stuff that's genuinely kind of startling and stunning and innovative and creepy and scary and often disgusting. Some of those people I am proud to call friends, some of them I've never met, but actually if you look in small press, if you look in anthologies, there's some absolutely cracking stuff around. It's not translating to mainstream, and that's, I don't know why that is. I'm not in publishing, I wouldn't have any clue about that. But I think horror itself, I think it's doing very well at the moment. I think it's just doing it very, very well, very quietly.
So it mostly seems to have decamped to the independent presses, and especially now that Kindle is taking over the self-publishing authors as well.
Yeah, Kindle self-publishing is a big one. Small press has been around for a long time. I think because we had the crash and burn thing, late 80s, all sorts of rubbish was being published and it couldn't sustain and it blew apart.
Right.
And as a consequence, then good horror then had to decamp to small press because there was nowhere else for it. Because that was the point at which mainstream went, not touching it with a barge pole, because we've lost lots of money on this. But at that level, I do think it's doing very well, and I'm extremely proud to be a part of it. It's great.
Of course, the second big question that's asked every year at FantasyCon is the state of publishing as a whole, which is broader than horror, of course. But from what you've been saying, do you think horror might actually be able to flourish as the old system of these mainstream publishers perhaps breaks down or diversifies?
I genuinely don't know about publishing. I think publishing is undergoing a massive change, but it has been for a number of years and will continue to as the shift from tree books to e-books, as it were, happens. I do not believe for one minute that hard copy books will ever die, because there are people who collect, there are people who don't like e-books, and the bottom line is you can take a paperback to a beach and not risk it being damaged, and you can't do that with an e-book. I do think horror has a place in that, but horror has always had a place in the same way that it has a place in film and it has a place in classical literature and modern literature. Horror is simply one of the things that we enjoy reading and writing and watching. It's never probably going to be as big as it was in the late 70s, early 80s, but that doesn't mean, say, it won't produce some real kind of, out of the ballpark hits. I suppose the other differentiation is, do you want to make any money out of it? If you want to make money out of it, now is not a time to be an author.
No.
If you want to be published and enjoy what you do, then now is as good a time as any.
Well, speaking of which, what is next for Simon Curtin?
I have a collection from PS Publishing coming out next year called Strange Gateways. I have a collection for the Spectral Press out the year after, which is going to be called the Spectral Signature Edition Volume 1, because I'm the very first one of them. Haven't got a title for the collection as such, but that's about half written. I am working on a novel. I'm about a quarter of the way through it. It's going well so far. I need to make some changes to it from feedback I've had. And I have a number of short stories due out this year in things like Gaslight Arcanum, the Sherlock Holmes thing, Exotic Gothic 4 from PS Publishing, which is out next year, I think. Steve Jones' Haunts anthology, Reliquies of the Dead, which is coming out, I think, later this year. So it's the same as it ever has been, really. I just write, and I send it off, and I see if people like it, and hopefully they do, and hopefully they keep publishing it, and while they keep publishing it, I'll keep writing it, and I'll probably write it even if they don't publish it, because it's quite good fun and I quite enjoy doing it. So we'll see where that takes me, I suppose.
Excellent. Well, Simon, thank you very much indeed.
That's a pleasure.
I'll be at the launch tomorrow night. So
marvellous.
See you then. Hope it all goes well. And thanks again.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
I'm happy to report that the launch on Saturday night was a great success. People turned up, they bought the book, they drank the free wine. There was even cake. If you haven't seen them already, you can find a few pictures on our blog. All in all, I thought FantasyCon 2011 was a bit of a triumph, so it's a shame that the controversy stirred up by the awards ceremony on Sunday afternoon has overshadowed everything else. For those of you who haven't heard, Stephen Jones, a prestigious editor and one of the organisers of this year's convention, has launched a scathing attack against Fantasy Society chairman and awards organiser David J. Howe, a name that will probably be familiar to all you Doctor Who fans listening. David is co-founder and co-director of Telos Publishing, a small press imprint that really cleaned up at last week's awards. And his partner, Sam Stone, went home with the awards for Best Short Story and Best Novel, the first woman to win the award since 1980. Nobody's actually accused David of fixing the awards, but Stephen Jones is leading calls for a change to the voting system to allow for greater transparency. Things have become so heated that Sam Stone has actually returned her award for Best Novel in an attempt to clear the air. I didn't vote in the awards, and, as I said earlier, I left a few hours before the ceremony, so I'm not directly affected by any of this, but it is a shame that a fun weekend ended on such a sour note. It's not in the usual FantasyCon spirit. But I don't want to end this podcast on a downer. We've got some more goodies on the way for you. You heard Simon talk briefly about his forthcoming story from Spectral Press? Well, I was lucky enough to speak to the founder and editor of Spectral, Simon Marshall Jones. Yes, it's another Simon with a triple barrel name. I wonder if we can get Simon Clark Duncan in and make it a hat trick. So, if you want to find out what it takes to be an independent publisher, and how the battle between hard copy books and the Kindle is shaping up away from Amazon.com, make sure you visit us next week to see what Simon has to say. And, as the late great Elizabeth Sladen stars in the final episodes of the Sarah Jane Adventures on Children's BBC, we'll be putting together a fitting tribute. All this and more at Impossible Podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.